V for Vendetta, novelization by Steve Moore, continued. Disc 4. Somewhat later, Evie made a discovery of her own. Passing the time until there was something for her to do, and trying to make her bedroom look a little more like home, she had found some fabric to hang over the small amount of bare brick wall that was visible between the book piles, and had now turned her attention to cleaning the dressing table mirror. As she scrubbed away the dust that V had allowed to accrue in what was, after all, little more than a storeroom with a spare bed in it, she found a motto carved in Latin on the frame. Peering at it through the gloom that nothing seemed able to dispel, so dark the walls and ceiling were, so dark the books that gathered there before them, she finally managed to pick the words out enough to read them.
"Vi veri veniversum vivus vici," she said aloud to herself, though as she did so she noticed V appear in the mirror there beneath the words, and she could only gasp in amazement. For a moment her mind reeled. This was like the old days when she was a child, like the tales in the storybooks her father had read to her, like the times with Teddy. For it seemed to her that she had spoken the magic words, and V had suddenly appeared genie-like in the magic mirror. And then she realized that he had really entered the room behind her, and his appearance at that exact moment was just one of those amazing coincidences. Yet such a strange one. "By the power of truth, I, while living, have conquered the universe," he translated for her, moving forward into the room. She turned to face him.
"Personal motto?" she asked, knowing his penchant for all things related to the letter V.
"From Faust." Of course, she thought. A magician. Who else would have the magic words?
"That's about cheating the devil, isn't it?"
she asked, after a pause to gather her thoughts. "Cheating the devil, indeed." "It is." A certain warmth in his voice expressed his pleasure at her knowledge. "And speaking of the devil, I was wondering if your offer to help still stood."
"Of course," said Evie,
her pulse quickening as she put down the cleaning cloth. "It appears that unforeseen circumstances have accelerated my original plan. As a result, I am in need of someone with some theatrical skill."
"I'll do my best,"
she smiled, not a little pleased at his appreciation of her talents and the opportunity this presented. "I believe you will," V told her, preparing to coach her in her script.
"Another doctor?" queried Finch, not entirely sure whether he was asking himself, or Dominic, or the empty air, or maybe the rain, which was still battering against the windows. It never used to be like this, before the weather collapsed. Now it was weeks of drought, followed by a month's worth of rain in a single weekend. No wonder what water they had was so rigidly controlled. With it falling so heavily, all this would be running off down the sewers and into the Thames before anything useful could be done with it. If the sewers didn't back up again and flood the streets with sewage, as they had a couple of months ago. And that hadn't been the first time, either.
"What does a detention facility need with so many doctors?" Finch continued, picking up his coffee cup and, finding it empty, putting it down in disgust.
They'd been here throughout the night, sorting through the tax files, sleeping occasionally in their office chairs, sending out for sandwiches when the canteen closed. And here it was on Sunday morning, and they didn't seem to be getting any further. The latest doctor was a Dana Stanton, one of a list that he couldn't quite remember the length of. The tax records they brought back from the ministry contained plenty of food for thought, even if a lot of it just didn't seem to fit together. Interesting, suggestive, but puzzling.
"I don't know," Dominic replied to his question, going through a folder of his own, "but this is interesting. The highest-paid person in the camp was a priest."
"What?"
Puzzling wasn't the word anymore. That latest nugget of information seemed just completely incomprehensible.
"The Reverend Anthony James Lilliman," Dominic told him, seeming as baffled as his superior. "He was paid almost 200 grand a month."
"That is interesting." Finch typed the name Lilliman into his computer search engine. "Looks like he was promoted," he added when the information came up on the screen. "He's a bishop now, officiating priest at Westminster Abbey."
Why on earth would a priest, whose official role at the camp appeared to be to ensure that rules and rights weren't violated, be paid that much?
unless it was some sort of hush money.
"I guess we're going to confession tomorrow, then," smirked Dominic.
"Yeah," Finch agreed, allowing himself a little smile of satisfaction, as it seemed they were finally starting to get somewhere on this case. "And I'll bet his confession will be a lot more interesting than ours."
10. Early Sunday evening in the deanery at Westminster Abbey, now Bishop Lilliman's private living quarters, found two men, one young, the other considerably older, with rather different things on their minds.
"Your Grace?"
the young man called, his voice somehow retaining a reverent hush while still carrying along the echoing corridor as he sought to catch up with the bishop. A marvellous opportunity for a young priest, he'd thought this position as personal assistant to the bishop would be, until he'd realised just how personal some of his duties actually were. Still, needs must when the devil drives, even here in God's house at Westminster, and once he'd got used to the notion and some of the perks and side benefits involved, it still was a marvellous opportunity. Just not quite the way he'd thought it was going to be.
"Ah, Dennis,"
the bishop said softly, pausing and turning to look back as the young priest caught up.
"Has everything been arranged?"
"Yes, Your Grace,"
said Dennis hurriedly, eager to please as ever.
"I've just received your interlink itinerary, and you should arrive in Perth in time to celebrate communion."
Lilliman smiled, but it was a smile much more suggestive of reptilian descent than pleasure, of tested patience rather than fatherly pride in his assistant's accomplishments. The sort of smile that went with his thin, lanky body, with the receding hairline and the almost shrivelled skin on a skull face. All he really needed was a forked tongue to complete the look, but Dennis had soon realised that the old hypocrite spoke with one anyway, regardless of what he physically had in his mouth.
"You are most diligent, Dennis,"
he began with a hint of sarcasm,
"a noble example for all those who labour in the name of the Lord. But..."
"Your Grace?"
queried Dennis, nervously, realising from the bishop's tone of voice that the conversation was veering toward an area where, today anyway, he didn't really want it to go.
"It wasn't labour that I was speaking of,"
the bishop said, with barely concealed impatience. Surely the boy should have come to understand him by now. And why was he looking so nervous?
"It was rather," Lilliman continued, "my final remittance that I was interested in, my last little joy."
"I'm sorry, Your Grace,"
said Dennis, more quietly yet, unable quite to meet the bishop's eye and shuffling closer as if, alone as they were, he was still afraid they might be overheard.
"She's arrived, but there was some confusion at the agency, and they've sent a new girl."
An inquiring look from the bishop, and here at last was the crux. But it had to be said anyway.
"A new girl who, I'm afraid, is a little older than usual."
"Older?"
Lilliman asked, annoyance in his eyes, but still with marvellous control in his perfectly modulated preacher's voice.
"Oh, dear. Not too old, I trust?"
"That is for Your Grace to decide," said Dennis,
dropping his gaze deferentially, hoping the explosion he half expected would never come.
"Ah, well,"
the bishop sighed, casting a glance heavenward.
"If Job could bear his trials, I suppose I must bear mine."
And with that he turned away, opening the door to his bedroom, revealing something quite the opposite of a monk's penitential cell. Thick Persian rugs, antique and purloined from the storerooms of the Victoria and Albert Museum, were strewn across the parquet floor. The double bed was king-size, or bishop-size, as he preferred to think of it, and round the walls were not the images of religion, but icons of the grossest lust. Child pornography. Young girls painted in the roles of whores. Very young. The sort the agency usually supplied, and not just to the bishop, though not to anyone who wasn't somehow associated with the government or the party. An exclusive agency, this. After all, it was run by the government. And there, a picture of innocence in the midst of decadence, blonde hair braided into pigtails, wearing a frilly pink party dress, quite plainly several sizes too small for her,
but which she'd forced herself into anyway, and little white ankle socks, stood Evie, a nervous smile upon her face.
"Oh, my," breathed Lilliman, stepping closer. "Your Grace,"
Evie curtsied, holding the hem of her dress pinched between her thumbs and fingers, and looking up, appalled but hardly daring to show it, into the lined and aged face of the dog-collared pervert into whose hands she'd fallen.
"To think that I doubted your loveliness for an instant,"
the bishop leered, running his eyes down her body from tip to toe and then back up again. Not the veal he usually dined upon, but a young and tender lamb nonetheless.
"Mea culpa, my child, mea culpa."
Thank you,"
Evie said hesitantly, wondering whether this was such a good idea after all, wondering how long there was to go before V arrived. Not having to wonder, however, about whether the bishop was a quick worker, as he took her hand and led her over to the bed, sat her down, and plumped down by her side.
"Why don't you let me help you with your dress, my child?"
he asked immediately, his tone of voice fatherly, his eyes burning with unsuppressed lust. He started to reach for her shoulders, stooping forward, his stick-like figure closing in like a praying mantis. But she shrank away, pushed his hands aside. For a moment he seemed taken aback. Surely the agency had explained precisely what was required. He paid them well enough, after all.
"Please, Your Grace,"
Evie said urgently, trying to fight down a sudden attack of nerves. Now was the time to do what she'd been planning, not to get involved in the bishop's disgusting little games.
"We don't have much time, and I have to tell you something."
"A confession?"
Lilliman laughed, annoyance disappearing. Perhaps the girl had initiative enough to make up for her surplus years, after all, and she was quite, quite delicious. Pretty in pink and perfectly succulent.
"I love the confessional game," he told her, licorishly, entering into the spirit of things. "Tell me your sins."
"This isn't a game, Your Grace,"
she told him desperately.
Why couldn't he understand? "Someone's coming, and I think he means to kill you."
There. She'd said it now. Taken the first step along what she hoped would be the path to redemption and escape. Hated herself for doing it, and knew it was a betrayal, felt exactly like the frightened coward she'd described herself as to V, knew that the description was absolute truth, and the only lie was that she wanted to do something about it. But if she could just keep her head out of a black bag.
"Pardon me?"
said the bishop in confusion. People in his position just didn't get murdered. Who'd want to kill a man of God?
"I'm telling you this because I want some kind of protection or amnesty. I had nothing to do with the Old Bailey, and I made a terrible mistake at Jordan Tower, but I think this should balance it out."
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"My name is Evie Hammond,"
she said, trying to get the words out before he interrupted again. So much to say, so little time to say it, and then it all spilled out.
I've been the prisoner of the terrorist named V for the past several days, and I'm telling you that at any moment he's going to come through that door, because I unlocked the window in the room where your man Dennis told me to get ready."
He stared at her then, the whites of his eyes starting to brighten with fear, and she thought, perhaps, the message was at last starting to sink in. He'd surely have heard of V with all that had happened since the Old Bailey, no matter how cloistered his life was here. Must have known about the Jordan Tower incident, too. The giant television in one corner of the room couldn't just be there to play the pornographic DVDs stacked up beside it, even if that was its main purpose. And if he was on V's target list, he might be high enough in the scheme of things to have heard about the actual cause of Lewis Prothero's death. But then he started to laugh. After all, weren't there two armed security guards outside the main door, provided by the government specially to deal with this current terrorist threat?
"Wonderful," he chuckled.
The child certainly had an inventive talent for this sort of thing.
"A game I've never played. What a delightful mind you have. I hope the rest of you is just as interesting."
A hand settled on her thigh, his aging skin like parchment, and began to slide up between her legs with a serpentine motion.
"No, Please,
Evie protested, bringing her knees together hurriedly. This was all going terribly wrong. Not at all the way she'd planned it.
You have to believe me.
Oh, I do. I do, the bishop told her wolfishly, forcing her back down on the bed. Let me show you the firmness of my beliefs.
Stop it,
she screeched.
Get off me.
But Lilliman was playing the game to the hilt by now, delighted even more as she began to struggle.
"Seems like I've captured the dangerous terrorist," he said enthusiastically, pressing down on top of her. "Now, how to best procure her confession?"
Rape was the obvious first answer. And perhaps later, if she seemed amenable, or even if she wasn't, a little carefully administered pain until she was begging for the forgiveness of her previous sins and the opportunity to commit whatever new ones he might have in mind. Yes. He hadn't had one who'd really responded to a good thrashing since that little brown-haired minx in the school uniform a couple of months ago. How could he have felt disappointed earlier? This was going to be absolutely sumptuous. Pushing and twisting, and with completely different ideas in mind, Evie finally managed to get one leg free beneath him, then brought her knee up between his thighs with all the force she could muster. Like cracking eggs. Lilliman screamed, automatically reaching for his crotch with both hands and rolling aside just enough for Evie to get in a right cross to the side of his head, sending him sprawling off the bed and tumbling to the floor. He lay there for a moment, gasping and wheezing, literally spitting blood, and figuratively spitting venom.
"You little bitch!"
he squealed, starting to crawl across the floor toward his nightstand.
"You filthy little whore!"
Sitting on the bed and massaging her aching knuckles, Evie watched and wondered. She wasn't quite sure why he was crawling away from her like this, but as long as it was away, that was all she wanted right at that moment. But he'd never listened to her now, and somehow the fear that she'd been trying so desperately to escape from had only dropped her into even deeper trouble. And then, with a shriek of breaking wood, the door was kicked in, and there was V, a demon in black, the cloak flapping behind him, the smile forever fixed. Sitting down on the floor, Lilliman's eyes grew wide with terror.
"Oh, my God! She wasn't lying!"
he groaned, sick with pain and fear alike.
"It's you!"
V paused then, struck by the significance of the words, and looking round toward Evie.
"I—"
she began, getting to her feet and trying to think of some word of explanation, of anything, anything to express the guilt and shame she now felt, that somehow made her feel even sicker than her terror.
"I—"
the mask tilted, oh so slightly, and by now she'd come to understand the expressions that supposedly inexpressive mask conveyed. Disappointment, understanding, and worst of all, perhaps, forgiveness.
"I'm sorry," she almost sobbed. "I had to—"
And then the words wouldn't come any more. All the ways he reminded her of her father came back to haunt her, counterbalanced against the awful betraying fear. Betraying him, betraying herself. She couldn't speak to him. She couldn't face him. She ran. "Evie," he said, looking after her as she fled. But by then she'd bolted from the room and nothing would call her back. Lilliman saw his chance then. The pain in his groin was still insufferable, but the pain of death would be far, far worse, and he found the energy to hurl himself toward the nightstand he'd been crawling over to before, toward the big, gilt-hinged and gold-edged Bible that sat there, closed upon it. A prayer before dying was the last thing he had in mind, however. Still doubled up with pain, he managed to flip open the book's ornately inlaid cover and reach into its hollowed-out interior, grabbing the ivory-handled revolver that lay hidden within. The Word of God and the power of the gun, the two pillars of the bishop's meteoric rise to success, of his very faith. If one couldn't take care of this terrorist, the other certainly would. Straightening up at last, he managed to spin round, pulling the trigger even as he did so. Two shots rang out, cracking open the silence of the evening like hammer blows. But the shots came too late,
for V had already leapt toward Lilliman Tiger Swift as soon as he'd realized the man was on the move. He was already within the arc of the bishop's gun hand before the trigger was squeezed, the inky cloak flapping round the pair of them, making it difficult for Lilliman to see anything at all, only to feel V's gloved hand suddenly reaching for his own, grabbing, squeezing, wrenching. And then there was another loud crack, not gunfire this time, but the dry snapping of bone as V's iron grip broke the priest's wrist, sending him screaming to his knees. A moment, then, as the masked man stood holding the revolver, looking at it contemplatively. "And thus I clothe my naked villainy," he quoted, "with odd old ends stolen forth of holy writ, and seem a saint when most I play the devil." He tossed the gun across the room, far out of reach. Lilliman, a wiry figure still hunched and kneeling, sobbing with pain and clutching his wrist, finally managed to raise his head, looking up at the dark, death-like figure looming above him.
"Who are you?"
he managed to gasp. "You once said I was the devil incarnate," V reminded him. "Remember that, Bishop? You do remember Larkhill, don't you?" Larkhill. The word almost stopped Lilliman's heart. But he'd hardly done anything there, he'd always told himself, except turn the blind eye that he'd been well paid to turn, and to avail himself for free of the same sort of pleasures he paid for now. It was the others who'd done the experiments, not him, even if he had amused himself at the expense of the victims sometimes. And that was all behind him a long time ago, a shadow in the past, eradicated like the camp itself the night it burned to the ground, long gone, like the man who'd burned it. Like the man who'd burned it.
"Oh, dear God! Have mercy," he gasped,
realization dawning, a realization more sickening than the pain. "Not tonight, Bishop," V pronounced, the words a sentence too final to appeal. "Not tonight." Outside in the rapidly darkening night, where the rain had thankfully stopped some time before, Evie Hammond was fleeing along the still wet streets as if her life depended on it, trying to get as far away from Westminster as fast as she possibly could. It hadn't worked out at all the way she'd hoped or planned. It had been a bad decision motivated by fear that ended in a bad result. There should have been enough of an alarm raised to scare off V, whom she hadn't really wanted anything terrible to happen to, whatever he might have done, and then it should have been a few hours' interrogation, perhaps a short sentence at the worst, a return to work and normal life. Instead, they'd be hunting her even harder now, undoubtedly blaming her for the bishop's death besides. And yes, although she'd escaped from V, she'd also given up the small amount of protection he provided. Though looking back now from her new, even worse situation than before, perhaps that wasn't such a little amount of protection after all. Wrong. Wrong. It had all gone horribly wrong, and now she was even more afraid than she'd ever been before. Terribly frightened that she was going to end up, unseeing, in a black bag. "Just keep running," she told herself. But that too brought back horrid memories of that night when she'd been running through the alley, and the fingermen... and V coming to her rescue. But he wouldn't be rescuing her any more. Not now. Not ever again. A dark shape turning a corner up ahead sent her scrambling into shadow, not a man this time, but one of the ears, huge, armoured surveillance vehicles, black as night, the incoming fascist government had swiftly realized the symbolic and psychological significance of the colour when it came to keeping the population cowed. It sprouted aerials and dishes, directional microphones and the occasional camera besides, both visual and infrared. And she was sure that was a light machine gun over the black glazed cab on an automatic swivel mount. They didn't used to have those, she knew. But with the way things seemed to be deteriorating, who could tell where they'd end up? Tanks in every street, most likely. And the ever-present whiff of tear gas on the wind, the way it used to be back in the days of the Reclamation. Threatening as a great black killer shark, the truck prowled slowly along the street toward her. And Evie, even though she knew it wasn't curfew yet, and so long as they didn't recognize her, there was no reason why she shouldn't walk the streets,
cowered against the wall and prayed. No one inside the truck, however, was paying the slightest attention to anything the cameras showed. They were ear-men, after all, and they were paid to listen. And the best listening in the Westminster area, they knew from long experience, was always early Sunday night.
"Oh, no!"
they heard the bishop gasp throatily, breathlessly.
"Don't do this, I beg you!"
"Children's hour at the Abbey," one of the operators said, grinning to his mate who, smirking, fine-tuned the equipment. Any minute now there'd be the girlish giggles, then the warm elfin squeals, and then the little childish gasps that always set their imaginations racing. Snickering, they listened more intently. But it was no young girl's voice they heard next. It was a man's. It was brutal, and it wasn't going to stand for any argument. "Open your mouth and stick out your tongue," commanded V, in a horrid parody of the communion rite.
"What the fuck?"
exclaimed the chief operator.
"I don't want to die,"
the bishop pleaded frantically in his headphones, that rich, sermonizing voice now reduced to little more than an amphibian croak. And then, as Lilliman started screaming horribly, desperately, and ultimately pathetically, the earman began barking hurriedly into his headset mic.
"This is Surveillance 109. We have an emergency!"
11. Even though it was only the second time he'd seen it, Eric Finch was already becoming thoroughly fed up with the sight of green and white vomit, now foaming in the puddle of brackish, already coagulating blood that had stained and soaked into the Persian rug. A good old-fashioned shooting at least left the victim with more dignity, or the same sort of knifing that had been done to the security guards outside before they'd had a chance to draw their guns or even make a sound. But a dead man was still dead, no matter how he'd been done in, and ex-Bishop Tony Lilliman had been done in very thoroughly indeed. Perhaps he deserved it, too, Finch thought wearily, looking round at the paintings on the wall, at the pile of magazines they'd found in the bishop's bedside drawer, at the hardcore DVDs. Little girls. Kiddie porn. The sort of thing that was supposed to have been stamped out when the new order came in, that an ordinary mug in the street could be shot for these days, but which the rich elite could have for the asking, it seemed. Put that together with what he'd seen at Prothero's place, and a sick world started to come into view, a new aristocracy full of decadence and corruption and hypocrisy. And these were the people who were supposed to be guarding the nation's morals, good, honest Christians to a man. Maybe V was doing the world a favour, taking them out. But now they'd never get the chance to ask Lilliman about that obscenely high salary he'd been getting at Larkhill. On his chest lay a single yellow and salmon rose, just like the one by Lewis Prothero. A calling card, then. Obviously some significance there that needed following up. And if they could just get something useful out of the young priest who was, at the moment, giving a preliminary statement to one of the junior officers. Of course, by the time anyone could respond to the airmen's emergency message, it had all been long over. But it was a matter of some pride to Finch that he and his coppers had been the first on the scene again. Even so.
"He's just ahead of us, isn't he?"
Dominic remarked, looking down at the rose and the corpse, standing there opposite Finch on the other side of the dead bishop. "Run every name in that file," Finch told him, suddenly decisive. "I want the whereabouts of every one of them. Tonight."
"Yes, sir,"
said Dominic smartly, then paused as he saw his superior's face fall.
"Oh, hell," muttered Finch,
and Dominic turned to see several finger men entering the room. In a matter of moments, they'd insinuated themselves in between the police and Dennis, uncompromising expressions on their faces and hands tucked inside their immaculate suits. Up there near the armpits, where the shoulder holsters were. No argument, their whole attitude said, and no argument was what they got. And then Peter Creedy came through the door, heading straight toward Finch.
"Pack her up. Here comes the finger,"
whispered Dominic, eyes quite plainly saying he'd like to give the man the finger himself.
"Get going.
I'll handle him," Finch told Dominic quietly, and looked up with feigned surprise at the newcomer.
"Creedy,
What are you doing here?
Several prominent party members have been murdered, Chief Inspector, Creedy told him coldly, barely bothering to glance down at the corpse. After all, a dead bishop wasn't all that different from any other dead party member. And Creedy had personally purged enough of them for corpses to become, to him, little more than statistics. He hadn't been known as Sutler's Rottweiler for nothing back in the Reclamation. Now everyone called him Creepy Creedy behind his back, though never loud enough for him to hear. Finch couldn't help wondering what his fetish was. After all, if an apparently respectable bishop was into underage sex, Finch had to suspect that with Creedy it would be something far, far worse. Probably something to do with baths full of tarantulas, or medieval torture instruments.
"This is no ordinary situation and requires more than your ordinary attention," Creedy continued arrogantly, as Finch began to bristle. "The Chancellor demanded my immediate involvement."
A flat statement, delivered in just about as unfriendly a fashion as it was possible to make it. Creedy had no time for the ordinary coppers employed by the Nose, for their chief or their methods. What was the point of all that sodding about with detection and evidence and proof in court, when torture and terror and the secret tribunal were so much more effective? The gun and the black bag, that was the way to deal with troublemakers.
"It's going to be very hard to run an investigation if you're detaining all my witnesses," Finch said sourly, gesturing toward Dennis, but looking Creedy straight in the eye, determined that he wasn't going to be cowed by anyone, especially the evil bastard standing there before him.
"The security of information is paramount," Creedy said flatly, as if it was a line learned by rote. "In these volatile times, mistakes such as Jordan Tower can no longer be tolerated."
That was it, then, thought Finch. He'd put one over on Creedy by getting his boys there first, before the finger. Worse, he'd got here first as well, and now it was payback time. The first thing to be done was to grab the witnesses and make things as difficult for Finch as possible, and after that all the supposed collaboration between their departments would grind to a complete halt. If only the Hammond girl hadn't maced Dominic, Creedy wouldn't have had a leg to stand on.
"If, in fact, Jordan Tower was indeed an accident," added Creedy with heavy emphasis.
"What does that mean?" Finch asked shortly, suddenly starting to get angry at the obvious, though not quite understood, insinuation in the man's words, despite his best intentions.
"The terrorist seems to have a rather intimate understanding of our system," Creedy said airily, now looking around the room for the first time, as if Finch's response were hardly worthy of his attention. "The Chancellor suspects there may be an informer."
"Are you saying I'm under surveillance, Mr. Creedy?" Finch asked flatly, fed up now with Creedy's game-playing and wanting to get to the heart of the matter.
"At this time it would behoove you to cease any investigation of matters that have long since passed," Creedy said brutally, "and concentrate on the concerns of the present."
Ah, there it was, then. The annoyance about Jordan Tower was personal, but that wasn't the crux. That had got Creedy's back up, but the real reason he'd arrived was to deliver a message he particularly enjoyed passing on because it gave him a chance to get back at Finch. This wasn't about capturing terrorists. This was a warning.
"You mean Larkhill?"
"Major Wilson is a friend of the High Chancellor," Creedy told him, with just the ghost of a malicious smile. So that was what it meant to be a career military man, Finch thought, whining and tale-telling to get the nasty police bogeyman off his back. But Creedy wasn't finished on the subject of Wilson yet.
"His loyalty is not in question."
"But mine is," Finch responded shortly, suddenly not liking where this was going.
"I've been a party member for 27 years.
And somehow he hated himself for saying that. It was true, but it rankled, and it wasn't anything he'd normally parade before others. Something he'd felt he'd had to do at the time, and he certainly wouldn't be where he was today if he hadn't. But not something he was proud of.
"Your mother was Irish, wasn't she?"
Creedy cut in coldly, knowing exactly which nerve to hit.
"You bloody—"
"Terrible what St. Mary did to Ireland, wasn't it?" said Creedy, turning away and barely able to keep the gloating, evil laughter out of his voice.
"If I were you, Chief Inspector—"
and somehow Creedy managed to turn the title into a term of complete contempt,
"I'd find that terrorist, and I'd find him soon."
Just for a moment, Finch started to take a step forward, fists bunched, almost tripping over the dead bishop in his eagerness to let Creedy chew on a knuckle sandwich, regardless of the consequences. But one small thought made him relax into a shrug instead. Just a bloody messenger boy.
"Evie?"
gasped Gordon Dietrich, opening the front door of his big, old and very expensive Bloomsbury home, and simply looking at her, stunned, standing there in the same pink party dress she'd been wearing earlier.
"Good God!"
"I'm sorry," she said nervously, helplessly, looking up at him in almost tearful desperation.
"I didn't know where else to go."
That was true to a certain extent, though secretly she had to confess to herself that it had always been part of the plan. When she'd first suggested helping V, in the hope that he'd take her out of the shadow gallery, and so give her the opportunity to escape, she'd always had it in mind to come to Dietrich, as he was the sort of man who had the status and influence to help her. Then, when V had involved her in the plan to assassinate Bishop Lilliman, she'd seen a much more obvious opportunity to make a deal with the authorities. But now that that had gone so horribly wrong, she'd really had no alternative but to fall back on Plan A. It had taken her nearly 2 hours to get here, as she hadn't dared to make her way along Whitehall, which, being the seat of government with all its various ministries, was too well guarded these days for someone like her to risk, especially when she was so obviously dressed to catch attention. Instead, she'd come along the Victoria Embankment, down by the Thames, occasionally dodging into the gardens to avoid passing patrol vehicles, then up through the back streets around Charing Cross Station, and so into the maze that was Covent Garden. She'd had to run for her life in Longacre, though whether the man she was fleeing from was a finger man, a mugger, or a pervert, she really wasn't sure. But she'd shaken him off, and finally she was here. And now there was still the big question that had been tormenting her all along. Would he take her in? Dietrich scanned the streets quickly, seeing no one and nothing except an approaching Fedco truck, dawdling slowly along the street as if the driver wasn't quite certain of the address he was looking for.
"Come on! Quick," he said then, it never occurring to him that Fedco didn't normally deliver on a Sunday evening, as he grabbed her wrist and drew her into the warm glow of the front hallway. "Come inside before someone sees you."
Moments later she was sitting on the couch in his living room, still hunched up with tension, knees pressed together, hugging herself despite the central heating, trying not to shiver. No, actually, that should be trying not to shudder. She couldn't stop gulping nervously, hoping desperately she wasn't going to be sick, or worse. Actually, if she could just faint, right now, that would be a marvellous relief.
"Here, drink this,"
said Dietrich, approaching with 2 large glasses of single malt scotch, one of which he thrust in her direction. Evie drained it summarily in 1 gulp.
Cheers,"
he added somewhat posthumously, eyebrow raised and rather taken aback. But there seemed nothing else to do but follow her lead.
"Gordon,"
she began as he brought the bottle near for a refill, and then the words all spilled out, uncontrolled and faster than either of them expected.
"I know every cop in the country is looking for me. I know it's horrible of me to come here, to put you in this situation."
"Evie," he tried to interpose gently, but she wasn't to be stopped.
"If they find me here, you could be in terrible trouble."
"Evie, listen to me," he said, much louder now, taking her free hand and almost shaking her as he sat down beside her. "If the government ever searched my house, you would be the least of my problems." Evie could only look at him in blank incomprehension. What could be worse than what she'd done in the last few days? And thinking only of herself, she completely missed that someone had said something similar to her only a few days previously.
"You trusted me,"
he smiled, and she detected a fatherly and, despite his name, very English side to him that she'd never noticed before.
"It'd be terribly bad manners for me not to trust you."
And when she still didn't seem to understand, he took the glass out of her hand gently and raised her to her feet.
"Come along with me."
A few moments later he'd led her down the stairs to the basement, and, when the click of a pull chain illuminated a single naked bulb, led her into a beautiful old stone wine cellar filled with racks of dark, dust-covered bottles. Obviously, Dietrich's half-hour paid the bills, and for quite a lot more besides. Some of the wines here, she guessed, would cost more per bottle than she could earn in a month. But exactly why he'd brought her down here she couldn't figure out at all.
"I've always said in public that I don't make art, I make fun of it," he said, as if this explained why he was showing her his wine cellar. "But the truth is, I love art, and I do whatever I can to protect it."
And then he stepped over to a rack by the wall, and twisted one of the old bottles. Slowly, and with a slight electric hum, the entire rack swung away from the wall like a door, leaving a dark space beyond. He ducked down into the opening, reached out for another pull chain, then stepped aside and ushered her into the secret room ahead. And Evie could only stare. There was only one other room she'd ever seen like it, and that was underground too, the Shadow Gallery. This was a smaller version, but it reflected much the same tastes, and definitely the same interest in preserving what was old and valuable, discarded, forgotten, and forbidden. Books, music, paintings, erotica of various persuasions, sculpture, and though there was less of the popular commercial stuff that V obviously treasured so much, row upon row of movies, on video, on disc, and even on original reels. Remembering how she'd enjoyed The Count of Monte Cristo, Evie let her eye run over the movie collection. An amazing jumble, from all times and all parts of the world. Easy Rider, Women in Love, The Golem, Dragon Inn, Woodstock, 1984. And then she looked round toward the far wall.
"Oh, my God!" she exclaimed,
looking up at a large and extremely satirical painting.
"That's God Save the Queen. My parents took me to see it when they hung it at Gallery 12. I thought Sutler had it destroyed."
And that would hardly have been a surprise, for there was Adam Sutler standing on a balcony and giving something between a fascist salute and a royal wave, with one delicately gloved hand, crowned and bejewelled and dressed like the late Queen Elizabeth II, only with far more décolletage. A painting made before he came to power, when he and his Norse fire rallies were still regarded as a bad joke by large sections of the population. Just how bad a joke only became apparent later, when those same large sections of the population were taken away in the night. They weren't laughing then, or ever again.
"He believes he did," Dietrich told her,
smiling fondly at one of those little triumphs that still made living, even in a totalitarian state, worthwhile.
"It cost more than this house, but no matter how bad I feel, it always cheers me up."
Evie turned away, letting her eye wander further round the room, noticing a large and obviously ancient book lying open under a glass case. She stepped closer to look, but found the writing foreign and incomprehensible. Just squiggles.
"What's that?"
she asked, gesturing toward it as she turned back to face him.
"A copy of the Quran. 14th century."
Taken by surprise, she inquired,
"Are you a Muslim?"
"No, I'm in television," he joked. "And there weren't any Muslims in television. Weren't any Muslims in Britain anymore. The lucky ones had been deported."
"But why would you keep it?"
Evie asked, puzzled.
"I don't have to be a Muslim to find the images beautiful, or its poetry moving." "But is it worth it?"
she asked with worried sympathy.
"I mean, if they found that here..."
"As I told you," Dietrich said, with a rather rueful smile, "you'd be the least of my worries." A sudden sense of tremendous relief and gratitude overwhelmed her, and without really knowing what she did, or being able to stop herself, she stepped forward and kissed him tenderly on the cheek, something she thought she'd never want to do that night she'd started off to visit him. And now, surrounded by all these treasures, she remembered where she'd heard that similar phrasing before. That, too, had been back in the Shadow Gallery, and the words had been spoken by V. And now she was starting to get something of that safe, protected feeling that she'd had there, probably more so, because if there was one thing she was sure of, it was that Gordon Dietrich didn't go round blowing up buildings or murdering people in some sort of vendetta. The only trouble was, she'd betrayed that protection the first time around. Well, she thought determinedly, not again.
"Thank you, Gordon,"
she said, smiling at his slightly bewildered, slightly embarrassed look.
"Thank you so much."
"It's all right," he told her gently, relieved that at last she was showing signs of relaxing, of letting the tension drain away.
"You know, this whole thing started the night he blew up the Old Bailey,"
she began, wanting to tell him everything, wanting his reassurance that it wasn't her fault, her blame, her guilt.
"I was on my way here."
And then her words trailed off as she noticed what was hanging on the wall behind him, seen there over his shoulder. Gorgeously coloured prints of the most explicit homosexual erotica, and displayed so prominently their importance was absolutely obvious. She tried her best not to stare. But Dietrich had noticed anyway, glancing back behind him and then smiling sadly in confirmation. "Ah, yes. You see, we're both fugitives in our own way."
"But,"
she murmured, still not quite comprehending.
"You're wondering why you would be invited for supper here in the first place, if my appetites were for less conventional fare. Unfortunately, a man in my position is expected to entertain young and charming ladies like yourself, because in this world, if I invited who I really desired, I would undoubtedly no longer have a home, let alone a television show."
"I'm sorry,"
Evie said with genuine sympathy, genuine concern. After all, whose business was it, in the end, what direction his tastes ran in? Surely not that of the government, the church, the judiciary, or least of all, the police. If no harm was done to others, if they were adult and consenting, then whose business was it? But people like Gordon Dietrich got sent to the camps, while elitist reptiles like Bishop Linneman got away scot-free. What kind of world were they living in? No need to ask that, really. A society that treated its citizens like that was a fascist society, and there wasn't any other way to describe it.
"Not as sorry as I am," he said,
but the words that might have sounded bitter on the lips of a younger man were nothing more than resigned acceptance on his own.
"But there must be others,"
she asked, desperately hoping on his behalf that he wasn't quite so terribly alone as he appeared. He merely shrugged, eloquently.
"Occasionally you read something delightful," he said wistfully, "or notice a rather well-designed woman's shoe, and you wonder. But the truth is, after so many years, you begin to lose more than just your appetite. You wear a mask for so long, you forget who you were beneath it."
"12. Same basic toxicology as Lewis Prothero," said Dr. Delia Surridge, pulling the sheet back up to cover the gaunt grimace frozen onto the face of the late Bishop Linneman. "You could get these poisons from any house in London."
"Thanks, Delia."
In her early 50s, she was a smart, attractive-looking woman, Eric Finch thought, although he had to admit he was prejudiced. She was a friend, after all. Sometimes, a little more. But right now he was talking to her in her official capacity. Chief medical officer, pathologist, autopsy specialist for the nose. Running the body back into its chilled morgue drawer cabinet, she asked her next question without looking up at him, almost as if she didn't want to put him on the spot. Or perhaps just feeling that she ought to ask but didn't want to meet his gaze. Maybe even not really wanting to know the answer.
"Any leads in finding this guy?"
she said, presumably oblivious to the pun, and unaware that the very word guy had its origin in the same Guy Fawkes whose mask V wore.
"Honestly, nothing yet. Nothing concrete."
Finch glanced round the brightly lit, clinically sterile room, where it seemed impossible to ever tell if it was night or day outside. Delia didn't seem to fit in this cold, empty domain of the dead. She was a warm, live human being, round-faced, though occasionally with a slightly weary droop to the corners of her mouth, but somehow she'd ended up here in a room cut off from the real world outside. Almost as if she was running away from something, or someone. People, relationships. He wasn't sure. Medics helping people recover, he could understand. Forensic pathologists poking about inside the bodies of the deceased, he didn't.
"There is something else you can help me with," he added, reaching into his pocket. "You started as a botanist, didn't you?"
And then he pulled out a plastic bag containing the rose found at Westminster, told her he'd found another with Protheroe, looked at her expectantly, his eyes asking what it was. And Delia Surridge stared as if she'd just seen a survivor from the dinosaur age, or the dead come back to life.
"It's—" she leaned closer, looked, and started off again. "It's a violet carson. I thought they were extinct."
Violet. The letter V. Well, that went some way to explaining it.
"He leaves them at the crime scenes," Finch explained, handing it to her. "I'd appreciate it if you could take a look at it. Any information could be helpful."
"Of course."
She started to tell him how it was a hybrid, dating back to 1963, and named after a popular actress who used to be in the TV soap opera Coronation Street. Was there anything there? Finch wondered, vaguely remembering the show from when he was a kid. What was the character's name? Ina Sharples, that was it. A blunt, working-class busybody whom he'd always frankly regarded as a bit of an old cow, but she'd been in the show for nearly 20 years and had made herself a household name. Probably nothing there, then. Unless his man was somehow obsessed with popular culture from back before the Reclamation. But no. It was probably just the letter V. His phone rang before he could take the thought any further. Pulling it out of his pocket, he just said, "Yeah?" Dominic was at the other end, and his tone of voice alone made everything sound urgent.
"I just finished going through the file, Inspector. You better get back here."
"My God," said Finch, staring as the list of names ran down Dominic's computer screen, as if descending inevitably into hell. As it seemed, they had. Beside every name was the word deceased.
"He's killed all of them?" Finch asked.
There seeming no other reason why the dates of death should all be so close together, so recent. Maybe one or two could have been natural, but as for the rest, no way. That would have been too much of a coincidence, even in a coincidence-riddled case like this.
"All but one," Dominic told him,
hitting Page down and pointing out Dr. Stanton, Dana.
"Who's she?" asked Finch, a rising sense of urgency and excitement tinging his voice. If they could just find her, get to the last victim before he did, perhaps even catch him in the act. Because if it was a series of revenge killings and nothing more, and he worked his way through to the end of the list, well, what then?
"Not sure who she is," Dominic told him. "She was clearly one of the people in charge at Larkhill, but after they shut it down she disappeared for 2 years, until she applied for an overseas visa, which was denied."
"Running away?"
"Probably. Because after that all record of her seems to stop."
"She changed her name."
Finch drew the obvious conclusion, one that Dominic had already reached.
"That's what I'm guessing," the young man said. "I put in a call to the registry, but I haven't heard back. But it is late, after all."
"Or early."
"Call them again," Finch said decisively.
"I want that name."
And he sat there, drumming his fingers nervously on the desktop, waiting as Dominic pestered and blustered his way through the usual succession of unhelpful, buck-passing civil servants until, finally...
"What?"
the young detective exclaimed in surprise.
"Are you sure about that?"
"Okay. Thank you." He hung up, then glanced toward Finch with a look of rather nervous bewilderment. This was news he didn't really want to give him. After all, there were some things his boss couldn't quite keep to himself, even if he'd never mentioned them aloud.
"Dr. Dana Stanton," Dominic said,
hesitated, then continued.
"Changed her name to Delia Surridge."
"Jesus!" spat Finch, starting to reach for his own phone and then tapping out her number. "I just saw her!"
Absolutely nothing. No answer, no ringing tone, just nothing. A cold terror almost paralyzed his fingers as he tried again. Again. Then tried the operator.
"I'm sorry, Inspector," she said at last, "but I can't get a response from that number. There's a problem with the connection."
"Jesus Christ! He's there!"
Finch slammed down the phone and lurched wearily to his feet, then hurriedly reached for his coat.
"Let's go!"
The night was still deep over Plasto, where a bright moon shone through a gap in the breeze-rippled curtains of Delia Surridge's bedroom. Asleep, her face had regained all the peaceful innocence of a child's, or the newly dead's. It was an irony she would surely have appreciated as a pathologist, if only she could have seen herself unconscious. But finally she stirred, drew in a sharper breath, and woke. Woke to the scent of roses, and to a dark, cloaked figure in a broad-brimmed hat, standing silently in the shadows, barely visible in the moonlight.
"It's you, isn't it?"
she asked, sitting up suddenly but speaking with a calm, quiet voice.
"You've come to kill me."
"Yes," said the intruder, floating toward her bedside like the angel of death, his calm tone matching her own. The hat tilted back slightly then, revealing the mask in the moonlight.
"Thank God," said Delia Surridge,
and softly began to weep. It was to be a romantic death, then, the sort she'd always hoped for but never dared expect, with moonlight and roses. Not with fury and violence, but with quietness and peace. And V, playing the perfect gentleman, stood there beside her in silence until she gathered herself, until the tears stopped flowing, and, finally, until she was prepared to raise her head and look him in the face. Or rather, the mask. The mask that revealed nothing, but eloquently said so much.
"After what happened, after what they did," she began falteringly, "I thought about killing myself. But I knew one day you'd come for me."
She glanced round then toward the nightstand beside her bed, and the red, leather-bound book that lay there. The book that, on some impulse, she'd felt the need earlier in the evening to get from the small safe concealed in the bottom of her wardrobe, where it had sat unread for years. Not that she'd wanted to read it again herself, but because she'd known that there'd be someone who would, even if at the time she hadn't been quite certain who. Known as well that this, somehow, would be the night of revelations. And, oh, how she wanted the story to be known, to escape from all those years of government suppression and finally be brought to light. It wouldn't even matter to her if it was only shared with one other person, and the story was never made public, but if she could just pass it on to someone, and lay down the burden of guilt that she'd been carrying for so many years, before she died.
"I didn't know what they were going to do,"
she told him, as if some final confession, or at least an explanation, was necessary for her soul.
"I swear I didn't. Read my journal."
She glanced toward the book, but if she hoped for some expression of sympathy, it wasn't forthcoming.
"What they did," V told her, unmoving, like a judge pronouncing sentence, "was only possible because of you."
A cold evaluation, that, and hardly the clemency she'd hoped for, but truthful nonetheless. And truth was something to be treasured after so many years of lies.
"Oppenheimer was able to change more than the course of a war," she said meditatively,
thankful if not for sympathy, at least for the opportunity to talk.
"He changed the entire course of human history. Is it wrong to hold on to that kind of hope?"
"I haven't come for what you hoped to do, Delia," he told her gently, and the use of her new first name seemed almost like forgiveness.
Dr. Dana Stanton would have struck her as much more accusatory, would have reminded her so much more of her guilt.
"I've come for what you did."
"Yes, I know,"
she sighed, shaking her head wearily.
"It's funny. I was given one of your roses today. I wasn't sure you were the terrorist until I saw it."
And with that she managed a small, rueful smile.
"What a strange coincidence that I should be given it today."
"There are no coincidences, Delia," said V softly. "Only the illusion of coincidence."
and then he reached into his cloak, pulled out something that seemed to glow palely in the moonlight. "I have another rose," he said, handing it to her. "This one is for you." She took it almost gratefully, held it close, and looked at it as if it was the last treasure in her life, and somehow the most valued one of all. A valentine from death himself, come now to claim her as his long-predestined bride.
"Are you going to kill me now?"
she asked at last, looking up toward him with genuine warmth in her expression. "I killed you 10 minutes ago," he said, showing her an empty syringe. "While you slept."
"Is there any pain?"
Her doctor's voice now. A last medical inquiry in the spirit of professional curiosity. "No," he said in a tone of obvious, reassuring truthfulness.
"Thank you."
Outside, on the still night air, a distant police siren began to wail. But if V felt even the slightest touch of concern about that, it was not at all apparent.
"Is it meaningless to apologize?"
she asked. One last question, while there was still time. "Never," he said, and at that the mask seemed touched with something of a real smile.
"I'm sorry,"
she murmured, as the rose slipped slowly from her fingers. And then there was only silence, as an expression of peaceful innocence returned to her face. Less than 2 minutes later, Finch's car screeched to a halt outside, the passenger door opening before it had even stopped. Cursing the amount of time it had taken them to cross East London to get here, even with the curfewed, empty roads and Dominic's dangerous driving, Finch ran toward the house and pressed the doorbell urgently, repeatedly. Waiting no more than 30 seconds for a response, a light, a sound, anything, he summoned Dominic forward and told him to kick in the front door. They found her in the bedroom, lying at peace in the moonlight, the bedclothes pushed back where she'd first sat up, her eyes open and staring fixedly at the ceiling, the violet Carson rose lying loosely in her lap. Too late. Too late again. And this the occasion when Finch had wanted most of all to be on time. "Damn it," he muttered, with mingled anger and despair. He wanted to say much more, of course, to rage and shout and curse the entire world and the God who allowed such things to happen, but somehow he couldn't bring himself to break the serenity that seemed to have fallen over Delia, her room, and all the moonlit night. Almost as if the world itself were telling Delia Surridge, "Rest in peace," and he could only add the same, remembering the few times they'd drifted together. Two lonely people in their middle age who'd gone for dinner and wound up once here and twice at his place, before drifting apart again the following morning with vague promises that neither of them ever really intended to keep. That bottle of scotch they'd drained together, when she'd told him pathologists had more to get drunk about than coppers ever did, and he told her plainly that they didn't. But even when she couldn't stand up any more and he'd had to carry her off to bed, she still hadn't mentioned anything about Larkhill. And then his eye lit on the leather-bound journal, still there by the bedside, inviting attention, waiting to be read. There was no way Finch was going to allow this particular piece of evidence to fall into Peter Creedy's hands, and the only way to prevent that happening, and to cover his exposed rear end at the same time, was to take it right to the top himself. So here he was, after a sleepless night's reading, alone in the cabinet room in Downing Street, looking up at the huge monitor dwarfed by the televised face of Adam Sattler. "It was found at the crime scene, beside the bed," Finch explained, gesturing toward the journal on the table before him, knowing that the multi-angle cameras around the room would be picking up a view of it well enough, along with every nuance of Finch's behaviour. Difficult to conceal anything when every slightest movement, every trace of expression could be picked up and examined from a multitude of different angles. And every word, every pause, every breath, and every silence was being taken down on tape as well. Well, tell the truth and shame the devil, Finch thought to himself, and that was pretty much how he was seeing the High Chancellor now, after reading the contents of the journal, and everyone else involved in this case, from those who were employed at Lark Hill to the political masters they worked for. A rotten business. A rotten system. A thoroughly rotten world. And that he was just another compromised cog in this horribly inhuman wheel didn't make him feel any better at all. But he tried to keep all those feelings out of his presentation as he told Sutler something of the journal's contents. Whether he'd succeeded, well, only time would tell. "The terrorist obviously wanted us to have it," he continued, looking up at the screen to watch Sutler's reaction to what he said next. "He wanted us to know the story, or at least a part of it." The reaction was pretty much as he'd expected. First time he'd ever seen the evil old bastard even remotely discomforted. Well, life had its little triumphs, mixed in with its larger, far more widespread despairs.
"Am I to understand that you have read the whole of this document, Inspector?" Sutler said coldly,
malignance ringing in every word. "Yes, sir." Finch had, and it would have been obvious that he had, or he wouldn't have known it was important enough to bring to Downing Street, so there was no point in lying about it. But there was still that gnawing uncertainty in his gut about what the consequences might be. He didn't want to end up in a black bag any more than anyone else.
"Has anyone else read it?" Sutler continued, trying to sound matter-of-fact, but somehow just suggesting he was looking for an excuse for further action. What they used to call, euphemistically, executive action, with the emphasis on execute.
"No, sir." Finch waited. It wasn't as bad as it could have been. After a few seconds of narrow-eyed contemplation, while he was obviously weighing the pros and cons of whether it was more useful to keep Finch alive or not, Sutler made his pronouncement.
"Then let me make this perfectly clear to you. The contents of this document are a matter of national security, constituting an assault on the character of several important party members, as well as being a blatant violation of the Articles of Allegiance."
A pause, and then came the statement of denial that would, true or false, obviously be the official party line.
"As the authenticity of this document cannot be verified," Sutler continued with heavy emphasis, "it could be an elaborate forgery created by the terrorist, as easily as it could be the deranged fantasy of a former party member who resigned for psychological reasons. So any discussion of this document or its contents will be considered at the very least an act of sedition, if not a wilful act of treason. Is that understood, Mr. Finch?"
"Yes, sir," he said aloud. "Bullshit," he thought in silence.
"You would do well, Inspector," Sutler said with finality, "to put it entirely out of your mind."
Finch nodded acquiescence, but the journal, which was obviously going to stay behind when he left, just sat there on the table before him like a bitten apple, refusing to be unbit. And the only thing that would get the contents out of his mind now was a bullet through the brain.
13. May 23rd, the journal had started, as journals do, though it had been quite obvious to Finch that the bare narrative of Delia Surridge's words had only represented the tip of the iceberg, the merest aide-memoir. The real memories hidden beneath the matter-of-fact record could only be conjectured. But Finch had seen enough, after all the times he'd lived through, all the government processes he'd seen, to imagine them easily enough. And if the world had seemed to forgive Delia Surridge on the night of her death, he had to say that now, after reading the narrative of all the things she'd done and all the other things she'd neglected, he couldn't really understand why. "My first batch of subjects arrived today, and I have to admit that I'm very excited," the journal's first entry had begun, and Finch, knowing Delia Surridge personally as he had, was appalled at the ease with which, from the very start, she'd been able to slip into thinking of subjects rather than people. People who would, he knew, have arrived at the camp packed into trucks, like cattle, probably without even any room to sit as they rattled along the long deteriorated roads. The people you didn't see any more. Arabs, Africans, Asians, Chinese, gypsies. people who prayed to different gods, queers and lesbians, political agitators, men, women, and children. But not solid British criminals of Anglo-Saxon origin, of course, criminals you could always make use of, as concentration camp guards, for example, the kind who would have been laughing as they directed the detainees into steel-barred pens, sorting them by type and sex, like cattle, tearing families apart, taking children from their mothers, and all with a casual violence quite unrecorded in the journal. If Delia Surridge had ever seen it, of course, or if she had the eyes to see. He'd had to rather doubt it, or at least he'd hoped she hadn't seen it, because if she had, it opened up a side of this woman to view that he'd rather not know. But then she'd been young back then, and the woman he'd known had had plenty of time to repent. And how easily, after all, we compromise ourselves. Who was he to sit in judgment over her? He always liked to think of himself as an honest copper, but he was still a party member. And he knew quite well what happened to the people he helped to convict. The country didn't have the financial resources to keep anyone in jail for life, no matter what the official line was. Surprising how many people committed suicide in prison these days. Yes, he'd thought as he read on, and didn't like what the thought said about any of them. She'd known.
I can't help but wonder if this is how Robert Oppenheimer felt. This could be the dawn of a new age. Nuclear power is meaningless in a world where a virus can kill an entire population and leave its wealth intact.
A misguided optimism that overrode all moral concerns, that saw progress in terms of replacing one horror with another that was only better when evaluated in terms of property and wealth. Science for science's sake, and an appeal to her personal deities, even if some held them far more morally questionable than she did. And always that same inhumanity. Or, no, it wasn't inhumanity. It was simply a lack of humanity, the same mindset that was only interested in test results and not the people the tests were carried out on. And mixed in with the victims they had been familiar names, names that, all these years later, had become victims in their turn. And certainly, Finch now had to think, more deserving victims than those whose destruction they'd presided over then.
May 27th. Commander Prothero toured the lab with a priest, the Reverend Lilliman, who I was told is here to monitor for rules and rights violations. It made me nervous, but afterwards the commander assured me there wouldn't be a problem.
I'll bet, Finch had thought. Prothero and Lilliman would have been thick as thieves, exploiting the situation for all they were worth. The thug in uniform, and the sanctimonious snake. Rules? Rights? Problems? We make the rules, and they're always right. No problem, is there? Fancy the ones in Block 11, do you, Father? Or is it the 11-year-olds in Block 1? Going to help them pray? Of course you are. Down on your knees, my child, and take the sacrament in your mouth. Oh, yes. Did I tell you about the time I was in Aden with those two girls and the monkey? Real corker, that one. Not that Delia would have known anything about that particular evil, being safely immured in the medical research block with her subjects. Though were the insertions she made with her hypodermic syringes really any less vile than the insertions of the priest?
June 2nd. I keep wondering whether, if these people knew how they might be helping their country, they would act any differently.
Except that it quite plainly wasn't their country any more. And what chance had they to act any differently anyway? Oh, Delia, what were you thinking?
They're so weak and pathetic. They never look you in the eye. I find myself hating them.
Probably, Finch thought, because the only alternative to hating them would have been to hate herself. And then the whole thing would have come apart at the seams. The pretense that this was nothing more than medical research, that inspecting the wards of dead-eyed men and women with lesions on their bodies and open sores on their faces was a hospital round, that the failures were properly buried, rather than taken out by men in biohazard suits and hosed with chemicals before being thrown into a hole in the ground, a mass grave where all the bodies of those who'd kept themselves apart in real life, the Muslims, the Jews, the Hindus, and the Christians, could rot into one another indiscriminately in a vast and fetid heap. After all, the overloaded cremation ovens would have burnt out long before.
August 18th. Of the original 4 dozen, over 75% are now deceased. No controllable pattern has yet emerged.
And then there were the last ones. The ones who, amidst the dreadful daily turnover of the general ward, had somehow managed to survive the longest, and grown the most interesting cultures, and had been given their own rooms. The ones with Roman numerals on their heavily locked and bolted doors that, being windowless and tiny, were quite plainly the prison cells she could never quite bring herself to call them. The rooms that, when the occupants died, were locked and given a chalk mark X upon the door, and never used again.
September 18th. There is one case that continues to give me hope. He exhibits none of the immune system pathologies that the other subjects developed. I've discovered several cellular anomalies in his blood that I have been unable to categorize. The mutations seem to have triggered the abnormal development of basic kinesthesia and reflexes. I suspect this may be due to certain pre-existing elements initially found in his bloodstream. Upon questioning, the subject said he could no longer remember who he was or where he was from. Whoever he was, he is now the key to our dream, and the hope that all of this will not have been in vain.
This book is continued on Disc 5.